Are you sure you want to stay here? It looks creepy.
But Savannah, this is the House of Mystery. Let's see, the brochure says true crime, conspiracy, alternate history, all rooms right here in the house.
I don't know, which room is ours?
Yes, this may be our room. Oh, well, sorry, ma'am. Obviously, this is not our room.
Ah, here's our room. True crime.
You've now entered the House of Mystery on KYAH. Utah's Talk Authority with your hosts, Al Warren and Kev Thompson. Also, Julie Saville with a paranormal report. The True Crime Commentary by Stephen David Lampley and Dr. Joseph Usensky's Conspiracy Countdown.
Welcome back to the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, broadcasting from 1150 AM KKNW Seattle.
And this is Kev Thompson, coming to you from WXEI, the talk of Crestview, Florida.
And I'm Julie Saville, and I am from the UK.
Yeah, that's too bad. Sorry. Okay. How's everyone today?
Oh, man, we're doing awesome now that CrossFit's over with.
Okay. Now, let's see here. One, two, three. So now, the story here I've got is that 32-year-old man died in India after being sucked into his MRI machine.
What?
Yeah.
How did that happen?
I don't know, but he got sucked in his MRI at the Nehru Hospital in Mumbai.
Okay. They must have had a diet that was heavy in iron.
Magnetic forces dragged him in, according to local police. And the oxygen cylinder apparently broke, emitting a fatal concentration of liquid oxygen. There you go. I get my MRI at the end of the month if I show up. Okay.
With a story like that, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. So now, yeah?
I've got a story here. This is bizarre. A school has showed a group of children porn instead of Paddington Bear. During part of the day known as Golden Time, they explained there'd been a failure in their filters that led to children seeing the inappropriate image, and the Year 5 children, aged 9, were meant to see the film during their assembly, but instead a pop-up came on the screen of adult porn.
Oh, wow. Wow.
That happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
That's what I'm going to say when I get caught watching porn. I was looking for Paddington Bear.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Only in Alabama. Now, okay, so now later we're going to have Steve Lampley do his commentary, and he's working on ballistics. And then we've got Joe Usensky calling in for the conspiracy countdown. It's the top three of the week. So that'll be kind of exciting. And, of course, we've got Nancy Grace coming up in February here with Dan Abrams because they're promoting a new show. And we all know how much I love Nancy Disgrace.
Oh, wow, you did not do that.
I did, and it's going to be that way. I mean, you know, I can't help it. She's just too much for me. So, no, I'll be polite, you know. I'll just be quiet and reserved and let you guys handle it because – it might get ugly. So anyway, and we had good response from David Wells. That was great. Good feedback. And we've had a lot of negative feedback from the Ken Urell, you know, the Betrayal in Blue Cop. I don't know what I can say about that other than we just try to have a dialogue with these guests. We're not promoting them or saying what they did was right. We're just, you know, and we're not debating. You know, with, you know, I got heck again for that.
What was the feedback about?
Well, it was all that this guy was, you know, he's a bad cop and he was doing all these things. And it was just a lot of stuff like he shouldn't be allowed to write a book and he should be in jail. And he's, there's a lot of swear words on these emails, you know. And so it's kind of like, well, I'm not the judge or jury. I'm just putting it out there and we just had him on and that's just the way it is, right? I'm just leaving it at that. If people don't like it, then don't listen. That's the best I can say.
And let me amend that real quickly, Al.
Thank you, sir.
I mean, can we not give people an opportunity for redemption and forgiveness?
No.
I mean,
the current climate in the country does not allow it. Okay. Octone,
okay.
No. Like I said, you know, we're just having a dialogue and leave it at that. Even Ken Krantz, right? I still get those comments that my tongue was so far up his ass that we didn't ask him the hard questions. And the thing is, we invited him here to be in a dialogue and a nice conversation, and I wasn't going to be attacking him. But they were saying really nasty things about me and a tongue and up people's butts. And frankly, that's fine. It doesn't bother me. I like it up there.
No.
Now, our big star today we have joining us is the Darkness Dave from Coast to Coast. You probably heard him, or of course Darkness Radio, and kind of the, you know, what can I say? There's just so much I can say about him. I've heard he's just incredible. So let's bring him on. I think he's sitting in a car somewhere on the street. I don't know doing what, but Dave, thank you for being here.
I'm living in a van down by the river. That's what I'm doing in my van.
You know, I had that impression, but I didn't want to give it away because you might get some, you know.
Are we totally done with the Pornington Bear story, or is there more to that one?
I hope there is, but...
That's all it said. That's the update currently. It just says that parents were really annoyed because they feel they should have been told sooner. and it says, you do not expect to have it in the school. You try your best to prevent it at home. Some children take it with a pinch of salt, but other kids are traumatized.
Oh, yeah. I need help.
Well,
Next time,
we'll send home permission slips.
Yeah.
I can't wait till Pornington Bear Part 2 comes out.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, pay-per-view on that. Oh, okay. So, Dave.
Yes.
I don't know where to start now. let's do some of the generic. Now you have been doing the paranormal thing for over 10 years on radio and things. Who were your influences to get you going in paranormal?
Well, you know, I guess the paranormal's been kind of stalking me my whole life. I've had experiences with ghosts after she passed when I was about 3 years old, 2.5, 3. I saw what I believe was a Bigfoot in Foley, Alabama, back in when I was about 10 years old. Then, you know, UFOs over Trout Lake, Washington. It's just, you know, I've had a really interesting life, and it's always been around me. And I had my mom and my aunt were, you know, always reading and talking about those kind of books. And, you know, we'd watch documentaries and sightings and In Search Of and you know, Unsolved Mysteries. And my mind was filled with that. I was fascinated by all the different stories. So that's kind of what spawned my interest in continuing to try to understand the paranormal.
Alabama, that was probably Kevin. It wasn't a big
deal. Yeah. I haven't shaved in quite a while.
Yeah, that's, you know. Hey, well, actually, But in the business itself of radio, was there anybody that you sort of thought was pretty incredible on air?
Yeah, I grew up in Chicago in the 70s and 80s, and I had the opportunity to hear just some of the greatest radio hosts, you know, from Wally Phillips and Roy Leonard on WGN, and Roy became a mentor of mine. He would actually allow me when I was a teenager to come in and sit in studio and watch him do his show and answer any questions, and he was fantastic. And then when I went off to college, I would call him and talk to him about the radio show I was hosting, and he would give me tips and hints and ideas, and he was amazing. And I grew up listening to the fantastic Larry Lujack in Chicago, and Steve Dahl, and Gary Meyer, and Jonathan Brandmeier. And I wanted to be a radio guy since I was probably 10 years old. And I used to sit in the garage with my buddy Rick, and we'd have that old black tape recorder and our Kmart, you know, blank cassettes, and pop them in, and we'd be Dave the Wave and Rick Slick, and we're counting down today's top 20 hits, and we'd do our silly stuff. And sometimes we'd break open a Hardy Boys book, and we'd try to act it out on tape and do like old time radio. So it's just always been a part of who I am and what I wanted to do. And I'm lucky enough to get to, you know, follow my dreams and be on radio and talk about the paranormal.
So what was your first experience actually doing a radio show?
This actually, how I even got into radio was a little bit paranormal. I went to Winona State University. And it was my first time away from family, and I waited a few years after high school to go to college. And I just enjoyed hanging out at the house drinking with my buddies. And they kept encouraging me, you know, you got to get off the couch and go have a life, Schrader. Go out and meet people, you know, aside from your four roommates, go meet other people. So I went out one day, and there was this stunning blonde in short shorts and a ponytail. Thank you, 1980s. And I started following her. Started following her across campus, and this is before stalking was creepy, and was following to see where she was heading off to, and she headed into the Performing Arts Center at Winona State University, and I said, oh, Performing Arts, I've done plays, this might be interesting, and I followed her in, and she started going up the stairs, so I followed her up the stairs, did I mention short shorts, and we got up to the hallway, and she ducked into one of the rooms. And I walked up and looked at the room, and it said KQAL 89.5, your radio alternative. And then the sign next to it said, currently seeking hosts. Apply within. So I opened up the door, and I walked in looking for the blonde, thinking, wow, she works at a radio station. I might need a job here. And I walked in and met a bunch of great guys and gals, and the blonde was nowhere to be seen. And they had me all signed up ready to start training, you know, the following day. And then I asked the program director, Howard, hey, there was a blonde with a ponytail and short shorts that came in here just before me. And he kind of looked at me perplexed. He goes, I don't think so. And I said, well, I followed her in here. And I said, is there another door she could get out? And he goes, no, she would have had to go out through the actual production room, which is live right now, and she wouldn't have been able to do that. And I said, I swear I followed her in here, and she vanished. So this beautiful blonde in short shorts pulled me through the Performing Arts Center, and that was it. So I was smitten like a kitten, and I ended up in radio. And that's where I met Tim Dennis, my co-host and producer, and we stayed friends for the last, 30 years. And decided to, he was working at a radio station that needed a fill-in spot on a Sunday night at 11 o'clock to midnight, and we started doing Darkness Radio on January 1st, 2006, and we've been at it ever since.
Oh, that is incredible. So, yeah. Honestly, I know this is going to sound like a dweeby question, but do you think that was a spirit guide that was maybe like, hey, let me lead you to your destiny, and I know what you like, so you're going to follow?
I don't know, but I'd certainly like to get in touch with my spirit guides more often, if that's the case. I don't know. It was. It was, you know, the motivation and the kick in the britches I needed to get out the door and go find this, and I did. And there she was, and that's the radio, and that's, yeah. I mean, so that was truly my first foray into radio. And it was a haunted radio station, of course, because it was on a college campus, the Performing Arts Center. And I think, you're supposed to have, every college has to have a haunted performing arts center. So we did that and hung out and saw things, weird things at night. I'd be there. I did a late night shift on Sundays called Sunday Night Softly from 10 to 2, 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. And I did all slow music by request. And I'd have all the lights down, kind of like Venus Flytrap from WKRP in Cincinnati. And it was just, it was awesome. And all of a sudden I'd see something move. And I'd go out and look, and there'd be nobody in the other room. And I'd get back in, and I'd see somebody walk past the window again. So I had those kind of experiences. So like I said, my life has kind of been embroiled in the paranormal, whether I wanted it to be or not.
So from your early experiences, Dave, and to from where you were when you set up the radio, how have your investigation techniques changed?
Well, I don't use goat's bloods or virgin sacrifices anymore. It's just too hard to get it out of the carpet. I used to think we had to have all the expensive bells and whistles and everything you could possibly need. And I kind of gotten away from that. I believe in using more who I am to experience the moment. And, you know, I use an audio recorder and a camera, and that's about it. And that's kind of where I'm at. I really like doing that kind of work when I do an investigation and just kind of being in the moment, taking notes, what I notice, what's going on, watching how other people react to situations and scenarios that unfold.
I'm absolutely with you on that. What is it that changed from, you know, thinking about all of the equipment, et cetera, to that understanding of the best investigators is actually ourselves?
I think it was just realizing how many times I'd miss something looking down at my equipment and somebody would say, "Did you see that? Oh my God, a guy just walked right past us." And I was like, "Damn it. No, I was looking down, you know, I was trying to turn on my K2 meter or, you know, switch on the SB7. And I just wasn't in the moment. I wasn't paying attention. And I noticed that when I stopped focusing on the equipment and focusing more on the surroundings, I became part of more prominent issues and more prominent, moments with a lot of people. So I prefer. I'd rather walk away with the experience of having witnessed and seen something myself than having captured it on a camera without my eyes. Because I'll question what I caught on camera constantly. If I see it unfold before my very eyes, I'll question it, but it's a lot more impactful to me.
So I've noticed from things written about yourself on Darkness Radio, it talks about you having participated in hundreds of investigations. And what do you think is your preferred type of investigation? So how would you have been informed about the alleged haunting? Where might that place be? And what would you do to plan for an investigation?
You know, that's varied through the years as well. I used to like to know everything up front and go in, you know, forewarned is forearmed. And I kind of stayed away from that now. I kind of like to not know a whole lot about, I just want to know it's haunted or reportedly haunted. I want to know where, you know, how long it's been haunted. If there's any name or two, I don't need to know their backstory. You know, if we know, hey, Josh is on, you know, in the house and Abigail, that's all I really want. Because truthfully, I don't believe they're stuck in one room. If they're in the house, they can probably move about. And, you know, they may get irritated with who's investigating that room anyway. Maybe they'll come to me if I'm calling them by name. And I've just kind of adjusted that way throughout the years just to make it as easy as I can and accessible as I can. And hopefully so the people around me can have a good experience as well. And it doesn't mean I don't use equipment. I like my SLS camera. I like my iOvilus. I like the, some of those tools. But I really want to try to soak in what's going on as well. I've been trying to, you know, open more to the environment. And I don't want to say become more psychic or mediumistic, because I believe you're going to see something or you're not. You're either, you know, tuned in or you're not tuned in. And I've been next to psychics who don't see anything and been next to somebody, you know, who is as psychic as a doorknob, and they see a full-on apparition walk right past them.
Yeah. Do you think it's, do you receive, hang on, I'm trying to word this. If you if you go on an investigation, is it usually something where somebody has approached you and said, we're worried about this, or we've experienced this in this particular place, or is it more paranormal groups?
I've hosted a lot of events around the world where we go investigate haunted locations, and usually they're not calling us in. We've booked the location, and we're bringing people out so they can try to have an experience. But I have done private investigations, and I usually try to limit those. I try to just keep those to, people that really need it and they're in danger or afraid, or they have children or elderly people involved. And usually it's more just to kind of talk them off the ledge and walk them through giving them back their own power so they don't feel that they're a victim and that they're powerless in these situations. And sometimes you talk to somebody whose kid has been terrorized by spirits in their room for years or weeks or months, and I leave and they never have another problem. And I didn't go in with my Ghostbuster trap and, holy water and smudge stick. Sometimes it's just talking to the kid and empowering the kid to let him know this is what you could be experiencing. And if you're bothered, tell them to leave you alone, because they may not even realize they're scaring you. And I'm sure they don't want to scare you. And once you've kind of gotten the confidence level up with the people that are having problems, their problems seem to go away. And then there are the other side. There are some people you just can't convince, they're not haunted. I had a lady who sent us a bunch of pictures, and all these pictures, they were Matrix, pareidolia pictures. You look at them and I see the shadow, and yeah, the shadow's similar to Elvis Presley's face, but it's not. It's just a shadow. And you can't sell them on any other thing. This woman insisted she had the granddaddy of all photographs, and she sent me this picture of this mining town in Pennsylvania that closed in the mid-80s. She said, nobody is there. Nobody lives there. Nobody works there. And I took this photograph. Can you see the guy standing in the doorway? And I said, yeah, that's not a ghost. And she got all huffy with me. And she goes, well, then explain it to me. So I went on eBay and I typed in James Dean cardboard cutout. And I sent it to her. And she said, well, I can see how you think that's what you're looking at, but I promise there was nothing there. So then I took her picture and I put it side by side with my picture, and I circled the hair and the red jacket and the handout and the white T-shirt. And she still could not fathom the idea that it was not a ghost. There was just no talking her out of it. Even though when I blew them up and you put them right next to each other, there's no denying it was a cardboard cutout of James Dean. And those were big in the 1980s. They used to, if you remember, they took Elvis, Marilyn, and James Dean, and they Photoshopped Coke cans and Diet Coke cans in their hand for an advertising program. So that was just part of the time. And, it's just, like I said, people want to believe so bad, sometimes they'll let logic go out the window.
Absolutely. One of the things that I feel really strongly about is that when people do paranormal investigations, they're investigating somebody else's experience. So you're going out and you undertake an investigation because something has been reported in a specific location, whether that be a big venue or a private house. And yet groups take quite large groups of people out at all different times, when if you're really trying to investigate something that's happened, you would try and replicate that at the same time, in the same place, in the same set of circumstances.
Right.
When I was, very early days, many years ago, undertaking paranormal investigations with groups of people, over the kind of years, I thought, this is madness. What am I doing? Because I just couldn't see the point of taking people overnight on an investigation where actually activity and the specific investigation I needed to make might have happened in the afternoon.
Right. Well, and I think it's all up to interpretation. And I'm like you, if somebody tells me that the ghost of grandma walks through the room at 3 p.m, I'm not going to show up at 10:00 at night with my team and investigate till 4 a.m. I'm going to show up at noon and start setting up my equipment and see if I can capture the ghost. And I'm not going to tape black plastic bags over the window to make it darker. I want it in the original parameters of how people experience these moments, and then see if I can give them answers. The fleeting ghosts out of the corner of your eye and, oh, they're all over. All right, well, tell me about that. When does it happen mostly? Usually at night when I'm sitting in my recliner and the lights are off and I'm watching TV. Bam. It's not a paranormal experience. Well, how can you say that? Well, I can tell you this, because the TV is constantly flickering. And if you don't believe me, turn the TV on in one room, all the lights off, go into another room down the hall and watch the wall and watch how fast, that light's flickering all the time. It's constantly changing. Your eyes are trying to adjust, and you've got floaters in your eyes. Those are the little pieces of dust and weird wormy-looking things that you'll see when you're staring off into space. And those will pass by through your eye, and with the flickering light, it'll give the impression something's moving. And so, you know, yeah, you have to keep it the way the investigation pristine. But in places like the Stanley Hotel and the Queen Mary Hotel and Waverly Hills Sanitarium and Eastern State Penitentiary and Rolling Hills, Trans-Allegheny Lunatic Asylum, those are all places I've been to. And activity just kind of takes place whenever it wants to. You can go one night and nothing happens. You can go the next night and you're hearing audible screams in the hallway. You could go at night and nothing happens. You could go during the day and your desk, you know, they're blowing papers off your desk and slamming your cabinet drawers. So it just kind of whenever it works. But let's face it, most people that go to large entertainment venues just to meet their favorite paranormal celebrities, they want to investigate in the dark because it adds the creep factor. It's why everybody goes to haunted houses at Halloween and they ride thrill rides at amusement parks. They want that moment. They want to feel that chill and that what if it happens right now. And sometimes the what if is all it needs for some people.
What's the single most, the biggest piece of learning that you've had over the last 10 years?
I think it's the fact that I don't necessarily believe we're dealing with dead people.
Okay.
In the sense of, you know, grandma dies and now her ghost is bumping around in the house.
Yeah.
I look at a location like a book. All right. The back cover is the beginning of time. The top cover is the end of time when the world just snuffs out. In between all of those pages, that is the location. So where the Stanley Hotel resides has always existed. The hotel hasn't, but that property has. So that's the back cover. And then every layer as they built up the hotel, and every year is another page. Every, you know, day is a page, whatever you want to look at it as. And I think that just sometimes those pages get a little wet and you can see the lettering in the pages behind them. And if you've ever gotten a page wet, you'll know what I mean. When you're reading a book, it'll kind of show through. And I think that that's more what we're dealing with. I think we're seeing echoes in time as opposed to real communicative spirits. But, Dave, what about this? I saw a ghost, and it saw me, and it ran the other way, and it communicated, and it – well, right. But I think in most of those cases, like Waverly Hills I mention a lot, look at – they were talking about how haunted it was back in the day, back when it was a fully functioning hospital. There were weird experiences, and nurses would see things and take off running, and they'll admit to that. Well, we're in there investigating. We round the corner, and there's this nurse, and she stops and sees us and turns and runs. Who was haunting who at that moment? If it's a ghost, why did it turn and run away from us? I think that in that moment, it was a time slip, and they saw us, we saw them, and that therefore it became haunted. And I think what I've learned through the time is that time, as we know, is not linear. So people that think we're experiencing the past when we're dealing with a haunting are thinking too much in the box. We may be hearing ourselves haunting, you know, the house. We may be hearing the next set of family that live in that house that's haunting it, because we're still in that same place, in that same spot. It's always there. It's just echoes that go through there from time to time, and you're able to hear them, see them, or witness them.
Man, you have, Dave, you have touched two of my favorite theories. And let me amend this one first. I'm with you, because I'm a firm believer of universes on top of universes, multi-layer universes. And sometimes we're looking into the other universe.
Sure.
And they're, you know, possibly seeing us. What was that movie Nicole Kidman played in it? Where she
thought,
that's it. That's it. I mean, that movie sums it up perfectly. She thought she was being haunted, but it was a group of people performing a seance and, you know, on the other side.
Right.
And so I'd like to.
Relative to how you experience it, I think.
Yeah, it's more physics, you know, quantum physics, right, than it is really paranormal.
Yep.
But I'm glad you brought up the creep factor, because I want to run this by you. This is another theory that I believe in.
how many people go to a location expecting a haunt, you know, like you said, you know, the rite of passage, Waverly Hills, Bobby Mackey's, you know, Eastern, you know, the penitentiary. How many people go there expecting an experience and actually create it themselves, be it imaginary or a thought form?
Sure. I think that's probably most of it, and people can roll their eyes. Listen, we've all seen enough TV shows to know three scratches mean we're in the presence of a demon. Well, if you're going in worried about bumping into a demon and you get three scratches, I ask my people this all the time. Okay, I don't disavow demons. I know that they exist. I know that they do wicked, evil things. But I can guarantee you, a demon didn't give you three little scratches on your back or on your arm. Well, Dave, it wasn't there before. You know, the mind can manifest amazing things. As a matter of fact, during hypnosis, yes, you can hypnotize someone to believe that they're burning and their skin will boil, their skin will bubble. It's a lot to do with the mind. And again, another perfect example, there are schizophrenic multiple personality disorder people who have two or three personalities, and one of those personalities is a diabetic. How does that work? How is that person's blood sugar crash when they become the diabetic personality? So our brains and our bodies can manifest things in strange ways. And I can guarantee you, if I started telling people all that you've heard is garbage, a real demonic haunting, when you get scratched, it looks like a checkerboard. And then you told that on your show. And then we told Jason and Grant on Ghost Hunters. And then they told Zach and Aaron on Ghost Adventures, and then it went over to Most Haunted, and that was the way. All of a sudden, I guarantee you, people will start seeing checkerboards scratched on themselves.
Yeah, and it just gets so cliche.
Right.
You know, I would think after a while that demons would become aware that we're expecting it, and so maybe they may start doing two scratches. I don't know, but we've always been taught that where the mind goes, the body follows. You know, to amend your example, how many of you have gone to work and somebody there has the flu and they start coughing or sneezing and then all of a sudden you start feeling, uh-oh, I'm a little queasy, uh-oh, you know, and you begin to manifest symptoms or sympathy pains, you know. We create a lot of our own haunts. I believe that.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm
feeling good.
Where does spirit communication, as in through leadership, fit into that?
I don't know what just changed, but all of a sudden I'm hearing echoes. Have you guys crossed over to the other side?
not yet.
Okay, good. Yeah, all of a sudden, whoever was just speaking, I could just hear wah, 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 a really weird echo effect going on.
Oh, that was the obviously from Charlie Brown.
So I'm sorry, what was your question?
So the question was, where does I suppose the view of mediumship fit into the theory?
That's a great question. I think, in all honesty, that we are, for lack of a better term, we are a memory encased a hard drive. And all of our experiences stay with us in this kind of card catalog of energy, if you will. And we're now finding, and science is realizing, that there is a real thing called genetic memory. That's something you can pass down through your bloodline. And it only makes sense. So what you're experiencing, the memories you're having that you may think you're reincarnated or so, may just be echoes or memories through your DNA strand. And I think what really good mediums are capable of doing, which is no less impressive, I think it's amazing, but I think that they can access those card catalogs. And that's why the messages are so fragmented, because our memories are so fragmented. Well, but Dave, they told me something I would have never known. This, you know, I never knew my great-grandmother had twin sons that passed away. Well, no, you didn't know that, but she knew that. And her blood is in your blood, and it's been passed through, so there's probably that echo memory resounding through your DNA. And it may just be a part of our personal Akashic records. You know, it's the family lineage records that they're able to tap into. So are they truly talking to somebody who died and came back? Or are they talking to somebody who died, you know, and now this is the memory download that's left of who they are?
But you can, but a medium can still then access that information about other people not connected to them in any way, shape, or form. Or would you say that they right. had been connected previously?
Well, again, it could be that they were connected previously. It could be the fact that they're, you know, I'm saying if they've got the ability to tap into this deal, they're probably getting seepage and leak over. It's like old TVs, if you remember before cable. The old TVs when you only had four or five channels, right? If you didn't tune it in properly, you'd get static and you'd get kind of bleed over from other channels and you'd have to tune it properly. So I think once in a while, they might just be getting bleed over from other people and other people's stories that are coming through. I don't know. I've got medium friends that say, yeah, that's probably what's going on. I've got other mediums that swear up and down they're talking to a dead person. And I have no way to disavow either side of that story. So it just, you know, it is what it is. But I feel like if I'm going to go through the veil of time and space to come back to give Alan Warren a message, I'm not going to go, okay, here's a bouquet of roses. All right, so the medium knows that means I love you. And now I'm going to show myself fishing because I'm trying to get through to him. I'm just going to say, hey, remember the time we went fishing? I'm going to be as concise as I can be. I don't know why there are these flicker moments. And I think that's why a lot of them is they're tapping into the memories. They're tapping into what is a dormant part of who we are.
How about this theory, though, Dave? That a medium operates...
I hate it already. I hate it. Don't even say it. I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
Oh. Yeah, be sweating there for a minute. How about a medium can operate like a radio frequency? Now, we were just talking about multiple existence all at once. And perhaps a medium operates differently and has that frequency that is able to actually reach into the other side and speak to the dead. Because perhaps the dead are simply energy themselves living in an energy existence.
And that very well could be. We have no way to narrow that band. But I feel like the messages are so basic and bland. And I'm pretty sure that if you guys were told I was the greatest medium that ever lived, I could probably take each one of you in a separate room and do a reading that was pretty much just a carbon copy of the other reading, just slightly adjust it, and it would make sense to each one of you.
Yes.
And I think if I did that enough, I could be very proficient at it. And I think that if that's the fact, that's why a lot of mediums don't want you to record. And they don't want to videotape it because they don't want you putting it up on YouTube. And then they go, hey, well, you know what? I went and I saw ABC Medium as well. They gave me the same damn message. So I've seen some mediums do amazing things. I've seen them pull information that I just don't understand how they ever got to that. So I'm not poo-pooing the idea of mediums. I've seen them do some stuff. I've seen some fantastic mediums. Michael and Marty Perry from spiritart.com are two of the best. Mark Anthony, the psychic lawyer, he's fantastic. So I've had the opportunities to talk to some of these people that can make these connections. But again, what is it they're really connecting with? And they'll even tell you, if you give them information up front, it may color the reading that they give you because they're going at it from a different perspective. And if I can color the true meaning of it, if I tell you this is what happened, this is what I'm trying to communicate with, now they're not able to necessarily define if they're getting real information or is it what they would perceive would be the information from what I just told them. And that's why most good mediums will say, no, don't tell me anything. Just yes or no, confirm what I just said to you or not. Don't give me the details because the details are what's going to happen. Right.
I think I'm kind of not sitting on the fence with this one, but I definitely think I'm, as a medium, I fall in between the two kind of theories. I don't know why and how I get the information I do, and I certainly wouldn't say it's through this or this means. So, I think it's the theory is a good one that we are linking into past memories of people, or past experiences, different times, parallel worlds. I get all that, and I think that's possible. I have knowledge of my spirit guide, but I still wouldn't say that I could absolutely hand on heart 100% say I get information from dead people. I get information, right, and I pass that information over, but where that's from and who that's filtered through, I don't know.
And here's what I will tell you, and I think that's fantastic, and I love that you're admitting that you can't guarantee me where you get the information, but the fact is you're getting information that is powerful and good. And here's part of where my journey has changed to. My mom passed away a little over a year ago, and we were very close. She was my best friend. She was my biggest advocate. And we were both fascinated by the paranormal. And 2 days before she passed, I said, "You're going to come back and let me know there's something there, Mom, right?" And she said, "You know I will." And it's been over a year, and I have never gotten a message. I've never had a dream about her. I've never heard 3 knocks on the ceiling to let me know that she loves me. There's nothing that's come through. And I have to stay away from most of the mediums that I know because they knew her personally. So I don't trust that the message that I get from them will be a true message as opposed to, you know, what they A, may think I need to hear, or B, what they think my mom would want to say. So it's, and they'll admit that to you. You know, they told me, I can get you messages, but I would have a hard time discerning, you know, if it's a real message or if it's me knowing you and giving advice. And I appreciate that kind of respect up front. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. It is what it is. It's a great mystery, and it's great to hear that people have this ability. And I wish more people would tune into that intuition and give in to experiencing life and making that connection with one another, because that connection exists. It is no doubt there. And it's just, how do we realize it, and what do we do to allow it in? Some people run terrified from it. Some people are grasping it and smothering it like a love that they want so bad, and it doesn't come through. I think it's those that kind of settle in the middle that just say, "I'm just going to let this be. I'm going to let this happen. And, you know, I'll develop it that way instead of forcing a round peg into a square hole and calling it psychic." And I think, you know, when you do that, that's when you start to see problems. But I will also tell you, there are a lot of bashers out there who absolutely hate mediums and psychics. And they're like, "Oh, they're just scamming the needy and the people that are hurt and broken and need some kind of validation. And they're con artists, they're ripoff artists." And I will say this, listen, I've personally been on a psychologist's couch, and I've been there for a long time. And every week it's picking scabs that I thought were healed over and making me mad or sad or disappointed all over again. But I've seen people that are like that, but they go have a medium reading, and they, in 1 hour, will pacify those fears and concerns and questions. If that makes sense, you know, that it's like, okay, so you spent $150 for a medium to tell you something that made you feel better and made you feel like there's a real connection. And you got that closure with mommy or daddy that you didn't have because you wondered if they're proud of you or love you or whatever. And that healing moment is more powerful than 500 hours on the psychotherapist's couch. And where is the real scam? Where is the real? I know I'm going to start getting emails from psychologists and psychotherapists, but I'm just saying, you know, I think there are flaws in every market and every healing modality, but go with what works best for you. And if you feel connecting to the other side and getting those answers will work, great.
Now, what would you say? What would your response be to a person that says that you're not actually speaking to any spirits at all, that you're actually speaking to demonic forces?
I would say, bring me the proof. Here's what you get. If I give you a message, right, and the message comes through and says, "Alan, I love you. I forgive you. It's okay. You know, I'm happy now." I don't believe that would be demonic. Or if that was the first message, and then Alan came back and, you know, "Thanks a lot for checking in with me, Dave. And, you know, should I keep moving forward with my radio show?" "Yeah, you should definitely keep. You're a powerful man, and you've got a great reach, and you make people's lives different. But your co-host has to die."
Yes.
Then I think you might have a demon. Right?
Whoa.
Then you might have a demon involved. If they start trying to push you to do things that are outside of your normal life and trying to make you do or act darkly. But I think a lot of people hide behind demon to give them a reason for why they do horrible, hateful things. And
touché.
Let's just face it, people are crap, and they make bad decisions because they're fallible, and they make bad decisions. It has nothing to do with the demonic realm. And I just think people need to take more accountability for who they are. And we, you know, we started talking about the demons as well. Most of these messages are messages of love and affirmation and positivity. And how do you call that demonic? How do you, you know, if that's demonic, then maybe we need to reevaluate what we think of demons. Because if making me feel better by surrounding me with love and comfort from somebody I love and giving me a message of hope is demonic, then that's not a bad thing.
Oh, well, they're just trying to fool you, though. They're trying to befriend you and get you to trust them.
Right, but how many stories really turn out that way? How many stories really turn out where at the end, once they've got you in, they start changing? That's horror movie stuff. It doesn't mean it doesn't happen from time to time. But that's when people go into haunted locations and do stupid things like, oh, the ghost of the little boy Billy, you can come home with me. I've got a house full of children. We would love to have you there. How stupid are you? You can't see it. You're going to ask it into your life? That's where you're getting into trouble.
Or you like to pick on families, huh? Well, come on, do something to me. Pick on me. Possess me.
Right. I don't buy into that because I think, you know, that's just asking for trouble. I did an episode of Ghost Adventures, and we went to the Demon House in Seattle, and I went into the room and started calling out the demon, and Zach and all the guys were like, holy crap, Dave, what are you doing? And off camera, I laughed. I said, they're like, wow, dude, what possessed you to do that? And I said, there's nothing here. There's no demon here. This place is more boring and flat than, you know, my underwear drawer. There's nothing going on. So if I felt like there was really a demon here, I wouldn't be in there going, where are you now, big shot? Why don't you show yourself? Why don't you push me over the railing? There was nothing there. Nothing.
Well,
and
Al's,
you can
Al's,
just...
That's my house.
What?
Yeah, I started to say Al's broadcasting from the demon house in Seattle right now.
Good on you. It's dead flat in that place. You guys know which house I'm talking about, right?
Yes, I remember the episode.
Yeah. And, you know, it was funny because afterwards the owner, and I'm not going to keep repeating his name because I don't want to keep giving the guy more cred than he deserves, but everything was getting broken off camera. Nothing really of consequence would get broken. Okay, so the ghosts were so pissed he was playing loud video games, they'd throw a candle holder. Well, why didn't they throw the candle holder through the TV? And when I questioned him about that, lo and behold, guess what happened the next week? His computer got broken. Something important. And the demons nailed his jeans to the wall. Why? Why would they crucify a pair of Levi's? That makes no sense. And then the 666 on his wall and the upside down man, the ancient Indian design, all of these things were sponge painted on the wall.
Oh boy.
They were literally sponge painted. There was like this, it was this very artsy demon who was like, oh yes, I'm possessing this place and it needs a splash of black right here. A nice 666 on the wall would be fantastic. That to me, it was an interior designing demon. This is just so wrought with BS. There was nothing dark about it. And I've been in some places where there's some darkness, and I think all three of you can attest to the fact you can feel it when something's bad.
Yeah, of course.
And there was nothing bad in that house.
Well, when I haunt someplace, I'm going to start nailing skinny jeans up.
The pants you can never wear.
Yes.
Pull the hammer pants out of the closet. At least that makes sense. You're hammering the nail and nailing the pants to the wall. That would make more sense than nailing a pair of jeans to the wall.
Yeah.
My old parachute pants from the 80s. But
yeah.
I was going to say when I went to L.A. and I was with, David Omen in his house and, you know, the Tate house.
Oh,
I thought that was just a show. You know, it was just nothing. I'll get complaints about that, but it was nothing. And I've never seen so many members of the media walking through a house and tours. He had bus tours going through where Sharon Tate was supposed to haunt. And it was, you know, For me, I...
It's kind of weird.
Yeah.
Isn't it kind of weird that they would go down, you know, four houses down on the left to go haunt that house?
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't understand it. And David Omen and I, he got very mad at me about a year ago because I wouldn't post his events on my page. And I said, no, I said, it's not fair to the companies that hire me and bring me into these events. I advertise their events. And he started railing on me about I'm nothing but a money-hungry pig and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, really? Because isn't that what you're doing is trying to charge people to come to your house and investigate? What does that make you? I just, you know, I'm being loyal to the people that hire me and pay me to do what I do. So, yeah, the Omen House now, I don't doubt that it's active, and it's definitely on some kind of vortex. Even Dr. Barry Taff has talked about that. He's been in there. It's made him so violently ill that he wouldn't go back in. It's a crazy place. But again, where is the activity coming from? Yeah. Is it from the land, because it is rich in all this like magnetite and granite and all that crap? Or is it the person living there? Is it David Omen's demons that are haunting that place? And I don't mean in the Beelzebub type demons, but his own machinations that have, you know, thought forms have created that are doing what they do. So I don't know. It's hard for me to pinpoint.
Well, you know, my problem with it was that when he invited me there and I was there, I had an hour, there was at least 20 other press agents and people there. Plus there was a woman taking a tour of about 15 people through the house. There was so much activity in the house. How would you, you know what I mean? There was just too much going on. You know, you'd have to have a private sitting in that house. It just didn't seem it was possible, but maybe it is, you know.
Anyway, I don't know.
Well, we're wrapping up this hour. We've got to say goodbye.
No, you'll wrap it up when I say you can wrap it up. I'm not done talking.
Well, you keep talking. We've got the Byron Lacey joining us.
Excellent. Well, I thank you guys for having me on. You gentlemen and lady, thank you for having me on the show. I appreciate it. And I had fun. I'd love to come back if you guys ever want to chat some more.
Yeah, that would be awesome. We'd always love to have you. You're always welcome.
Fantastic. Well, thank you guys. Have a great rest of your day. And be nice to one another. Be kind. Love one another. And I'll talk to you again.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Awesome. Hi, thank you, Dave.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Welcome to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Discussions of forensics, how it's done, and true crime interest.
All right, welcome back to Stephen's True Crime Commentary. Of course, as usual, I am Stephen David Lampley, and I want to welcome you back to another commentary. The last time we finished with ballistics, and it turned out to be a lot longer series than I anticipated, but there was so much information that I wanted to impart to you and give to you that cutting it short just didn't feel right. So I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you got something out of it. Listen, the reason I do these commentaries is to give you factual information on forensics and true crime. There's just so much bad information out there that I just simply felt compelled to give you the real info, and I hope you're enjoying these commentaries. If you are enjoying them, may I ask a favor of you, please? Go to my website, www.stephendavidlampley.com, and if you would, shoot me a message on, say, hey, I like these, I love these, I like them because, tell me why, give me some feedback and let me know what you like. If there's something even that you'd like to hear me talk about, shoot me that as well. I do read all of the messages myself. No one else reads them. I read everyone that comes in, so just shoot me a message, let me know what you like. All right, we're going to talk about something that hasn't existed except in relatively modern history. It didn't exist a few years ago, and it didn't exist so much back when I was a police officer because of the advent in fairly recent times of true crime television. We're going to talk about what's called the CSI effect. Now, the basic premise of the CSI effect is that the investigative and forensic techniques and procedures that are sometimes portrayed on certain fictional crime shows just do not happen in the real world. And sometimes these impacted expectations people have regarding what law enforcement, forensics experts, judges, and defense and prosecuting attorneys are capable of doing is impossible. Impossible, it doesn't happen. Now, the CSI effect is a virtual forensic and law enforcement utopia. That is, if it existed. Where else except on television can you get DNA evidence results back in under an hour? That does not happen in the real world, I can tell you. Where else on, but on television can you get fingerprints on all evidence? It's amazing. Where else but on television can you get fingerprint matches in 100% of your criminal investigations? Where else but on television can you have homicides solved in minutes? Utopia? Yeah, of course. Reality? Not hardly. All right, now the perception of jurors that the procedures and methods seen on such television shows as CSI, which is, of course, where this effect got its name from, and others are not always the reality. The belief that that law enforcement can produce miraculous results as seen on television is called, again, the CSI effect. Far too many jurors expect miracles. They expect to see forensic evidence that simply may not exist or may just be impossible to obtain, but yet they still want to see that. They expect to see in the courtroom what they see on television. They expect to see the fantasy land of unrealistic forensic expectations. It just doesn't happen, folks. Now, this causes a lot of problems for law enforcement attorneys, forensics experts, judges, as well as witnesses and defendants. It doesn't stop with the legal representatives of the criminal system per se. It also affects witnesses and defendants. Now, while it can also cause considerable problems for those folks, it can also cause criminals to change the way they commit their crime. Watching television, learn what not to do, what to do, how to do it, when to do it. Criminals can use this information. Now, all this is in response to some misrepresentations by a handful of television shows that this portraying skewed or impossible forensic procedures. It's just impossible. Now, some of the problems that the CSI effect causes can be expected evidence, again, as we talked about. From watching TV, jurors are expecting to see the similar evidence in court, and this is causing some jurors, or some juries rather, to acquit a defendant when the jurors do not get what they see on TV. And that's totally unrealistic. But yet some criminals, in some cases I have been told about, are able to walk free on acquittal because the juries did not get what they were expecting. Another problem is it puts strain on an already backlog forensic system. Labs, forensic personnel to produce this evidence, sometimes it's not needed or not wanted for a particular type of case. Another problem is having to explain to jurors the real-world facts and attempt to dispel the unreasonable techniques and procedures that they're expecting to see. There's literally expert witnesses being brought into court to explain the reality, to try to bypass what the jurors may be expecting in fantasy. Television shows showing these fantasy forensic investigative techniques, which is part of the problem. Now, outside the courtroom, a negative impact of the CSI effect is that, like I said, some criminals are changing how they commit their crimes. They're learning how to do better. They're learning how to commit crimes better. They're learning how to cover their tracks. They're learning what forensic personnel are looking for. And they're adjusting the way they're committing their crimes. And to be honest, there's some crimes are becoming harder to solve. All right, listen, time is up. I'm going to get out of here, and I thank you for joining me, and I look forward to having you come back next time. I invite you, if you would, to check out my books. You can go to my website, www.stephendavidlampley.com, and click on the author link. I look forward to seeing you next time.
Thank you for tuning into Stephen's True Crime Commentary, heard across America. You are invited to visit Stephen's website for information on his books, speaking dates, and speaking programs like How to Catch a Liar. In this seminar, Stephen explains some of the very same techniques police detectives use to help them determine if someone is lying. You will learn such things as global versus individual indicators, use of contractions, voice tone, eye shift, evasion, allusion, pronoun usage, question pause, base shift, and much more. Go to StephenDavidLampley.com for information on this seminar and much more.
Stephen's True Crime Commentary is a production of Something Weird Media and West 53rd Productions, with music by JasonLampley.com.